This holiday, BMW has reunited three members of the family at the BMW Roadhome Sales Event. The Agile X3, engineered for any adventure. The plug-in hybrid X5, commanding the streets with unmatched presence. And the all-electric i4, charging into the future with impeccable performance. Hurry in to find what powers your journey at the BMW Roadhome Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine.
Hurry in for exceptional offers through December 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
Season 2 of The Sunshine Place is the story of an experimental drug rehab for teenagers called Straight Incorporated, where kidnapping, brainwashing, and torture were disguised as therapy. It's the origin story of the troubled teen industry. How do I know this? Because I lived through it. The Sunshine Place, an Odyssey original podcast in association with Robert Downey Jr. and Susan Downey, is available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back in studio with Sean Scanlon, comptroller here in Connecticut. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good morning. How are you? It sounds like you're not doing good today.
It's not that I'm not doing well. I am worried that there was weird noises in my ear, and I'm trying to do a good job. So it's my fault, though. I spilled water on a 45-year-old audio board. But we don't have a ton of time, so I want to make sure we talk about some important stuff. I was struck by some of the candor within the Democratic Party. Now, I'm unaffiliated. I'm an independent. I've almost always have a split ticket ballot. So I come at it with no agenda. But I do think that this election, both the approach to it, the results, and the reaction to it, it's a big moment for your party. Maybe not in Connecticut, per se, but definitely nationally. And I think since we don't have a ton of time, what are your general, just start generally with your thoughts on sort of like what happened?
I don't think Trump won. I think the Democratic Party lost. And that's my hottest take of all this. And I think what we do with that information is the most important. And I think, you know, listen, there's everything on the continuum of we did nothing wrong to it's time for a full-scale appraisal of where we are. It's somewhere in the middle of that, right? We won seats here in Connecticut. The Democratic brand in Connecticut is very strong. And I think we have found a good way to talk about issues here in Connecticut where we're being fiscally responsible. We are protecting Connecticut's core values, and we're trying to move the state forward. So the brand is very healthy here in Connecticut. Nationally, not so much, right? We lost a lot of seats that I think we should have won. But at the end of the day, I think we have to figure out where we go from here, and I think it's a pretty good path forward.
So how about this, the social issue versus pocketbooks? Like, supposedly the party of tolerance and inclusion, the actual perception for most of the country, more than half the country, is that it's actually intolerance and exclusion.
Yeah, and that's a big problem for us. It's a problem because we have been allowed ourselves to become caricatures. And half the country believes that we are just not for them and that we can't possibly be for them because we've been defined by all these values that in some ways we do have them, in some ways we do not at all. And I think what we need to do is to find out ways to go and actually talk to people again. Trump had a 55% unfair ability rating in most of the exit polls that came out on Election Day, which means that millions of Americans and tens of thousands of people here in Connecticut voted for someone they did not like.
Right.
And the answer for that and why they did that is confusing to a lot of people. It's not confusing to me. They voted for him because they felt like, even though they don't like him, that the Democratic Party did not understand them and did not have their backs, and they lost confidence in our ability to get stuff done for them. Sometimes it's because of cultural issues that they feel like we no longer resonate with them, but most of the time it's because of the pocketbook issues.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sort of fascinated with the whole concept of, I don't know, Seth Moulton, the congressman of Massachusetts, he is Democrat, and he admitted, you know, I'm a little uncomfortable. I have daughters. I'm a little uncomfortable with the athletic side of the trans issue. And he gets pilloried by the far left. And I guess for me, it's like, and it's the same with voter ID. I think it's important to be able to have the conversation, like the whole, forget about cancel culture. I hate the term, but like, I think it's okay. You want to be safe, to be honest, to have a dialogue. And so like that to me, the problem is that sometimes it's impossible to have the dialogue even if, because if you're not, for me, it's like, I'm unsure. I don't know everything. It makes me a little uncomfortable, but I don't want to say anything because I don't want to get run out of the building.
Well, that's the
problem. How do you protect the interests of those who need protecting, but also have the conversations that, you know, people are thinking about?
We always say as Democrats that we're proud that we have a big tent. But then when people start to talk about how we need to be inclusive of different viewpoints in the big tent, people start to freak out. And I think that is probably one of the biggest things we have to figure out. Again, I don't think it's so much that we need to do like a full-scale reboot of the Democratic Party. And I certainly don't think, you know, there's a lot of hot takes out there. We need to run to the center. We need to run to the far left. I think it's more that we have to figure out how to win back the people who have lost confidence in us. And I think a lot of that starts with just figuring out how to make sure that our party can actually be inclusive of people with different kind of ideas that maybe go against the core grain of what has become the accepted ideal of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, how do you do that? How long it takes are two really big questions. All right, we're back with Sean Scanlon, Connecticut comptroller here on Bryan & Company. I don't know how much we can further that issue until we see what happens, but I think that the time of, I don't know, some of the more elite Democrat, I mean, like, is Nancy Pelosi's career over? Like, I mean, are there young politicians like you that get it, like you seem to get it, who are going to step into the breach in leadership in the party?
Yeah, I think if this election taught us other lessons, I think it's that people are yearning for new voices and new people to step up and people that are not just new, but maybe able to meet the moment in terms of just being authentic and actually answering questions and not filibustering a journalist question for 25 minutes, just having honest conversations. I think that at the end of the day, the more we have honest conversations with each other about politics, the more I think we can find common ground. And when I say that to people, they're like, that sounds so naive. That sounds like Barack Obama. That sounds like 20 years ago. I live that in my own life. I was just telling you off air that my son plays hockey. I'm at the hockey rink every single weekend talking to dudes that probably do not agree with me about politics. But even in those conversations, we find commonality. We find common ground. And I think the more we do that, the better. In this moment, there's going to be a big rush to sort of go back to our corners. Some of my colleagues in the Democratic Party are getting ready to lead the resistance again against Donald Trump. Listen, I get people are scared. I get people are concerned. I get they're worried. And we will stand up and protect Connecticut values if the president comes after them. But I think the moment of just simply fighting and opposing everything he's doing is not going to help us win back the people we lost.
And I, you know, there's a lot to talk about with the pending Trump presidency. Maybe we'll put a pin in that. I will say that I Kamala Harris and Biden, when they say we share more in common than we don't, you know, we have more in common than we have differences. I think that's true, but I also didn't believe them. Right. So, like, I think that's like to your point, like the way they said it, I think we have to get in this post JFK. I want a statesman, but we also need someone who's accessible. Like, and I don't know how that works. Nationally,
you didn't believe them because you didn't think they believed it, or you don't think that they were capable of doing it?
I think the way they speak to me makes it not as believable.
OK.
Like the authenticity, sincerity she tried to put forth wasn't, I wasn't feeling it. Right. Your points are made and they're well taken. I want to you mentioned something, and I want to transition with Sean Scanlon, Connecticut comptroller. Since we're such a blue state, will Connecticut get punished? Like, will there be funding priority issues? Like, do you think it's an issue?
It's definitely an issue, right? I mean, listen, healthcare is something I spent a lot of time on. The Affordable Care Act was unpopular when it was first created. Now it's popular. 90% of the people who are getting health insurance through the Affordable Care Act get subsidies for that health insurance. Those subsidies end in calendar year 2025. Is Donald Trump going to renew those subsidies?
Probably not.
Probably not. No. So that means 90% of people, 110,000 of them, so about 90,000 people in this state, are going to lose their health care coverage. That's not great, right? And I think where we go from here is to talk about why that's not great and what we want to do to help those people. Sometimes we'll be able to help them at the state level, but our ability to help them at the state level will be constricted by our financial constrictions. So we'll be able to make the case. There's a number of issues that we could spend all day talking about of where I think there's going to be a consequence. At the end of the day, what I'm saying is I think our party needs to be there to sort of say, hey, I know you might have voted for this person for cultural reasons or because you thought that he had your back, but look at the actual things he does. And then we have to have a plan to say, this is what we would do differently.
I think the former isn't as productive as the latter. I mean, I think you need to, I think it's an important point to make for people listening is that look at the things that might get, say, quote unquote, cut to oversimplify, and then have a response ready to try to step in and help people. And I don't know what the budgetary pressure will be on that or not. We're talking with Sean Scanlon, a Connecticut comptroller here on Brian & Company. The last national thing before I get to the state, because the Department of Government Efficiency.
Yeah.
Who knows what it's, I mean, they were saying that they would wanted to, you know, it's what, like a $6.5-7 trillion budget. They would take out $2 trillion. That would cause, it's going to cause a lot of, if they did do that, it would cause a recession. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
Government's a huge employer. But I believe in balanced budgets, and I'd like to get the deficit and the debt in check. So conceptually, a more streamlined government is something I'm interested in. I'm worried about draconian measures or whatever. I just didn't know, since you're like an efficiency guy, you know, like, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think there's a difference between efficiency and a targeted destruction of something. And I think that this is more a targeted destruction of something than it is an earnest effort to...
Destruction of?
Government, right? I think there's been a concerted effort to destroy government. And government gets a bad rap. And I think that government is there for people. You may want to minimize it in your life until you need it, right? And that's the thing about government. Should we make it more efficient? Absolutely. Should we find waste, fraud, and abuse? Totally. But putting two out-of-touch billionaires in charge of doing that is probably not the best way to do this, unless what you want is for them to take a flamethrower to the institution of government.
But say I was president, and I called you up and said, Sean, I want to balance the budget.
I can do it because I know how to do it.
How?
Because I understand it, right?
Okay, but like specifically, like you have this massively bloated government, right, with tons of wasteful spending.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't give me the specifics, obviously, but like people are going to have to lose jobs if you're going to streamline government and balance the budget.
There's a concept that Republicans often talk about when they run for office called zero-based budgeting, which is basically instead of doing the budget like we do it now, where we say, okay, do we have a surplus or a deficit? What do we need to plug? They start from the beginning and say, let's act like nothing is there and let's rebuild this from the bottom up and evaluate, do we still need this? Do we still need that? Do we need to do as much for this? We don't really do that in government, and I think we should. It's not popular to say, but I think it's an important concept. That's how you would effectively do it, is to say, okay, we have this humongous budget. We don't ever have to balance the budget in Washington because they just keep adding to the debt, right. Democrat and Republican.
Yep.
Trump did it. Biden did
both
it.
Sides,
Obama
yep.
did it. Bush did it. That's how you do it. You start from the bottom and say, what do we actually get from the money that we're spending? And is there a way to do this more efficiently? Again, we can all agree that we should try to do that. How we do it is the difference between our parties.
But either way, even if you were mandated to do it, there would be some potential economic suffering because of it.
I don't know if this is for...
This holiday, BMW has reunited three members of the family at the BMW Road Home Sales Event. The Agile X3, engineered for any adventure. The plug-in hybrid X5, commanding the streets with unmatched presence. And the all-electric i4, charging into the future with impeccable performance. Hurry in to find what powers your journey at the BMW Road Home Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine.
Hurry in for exceptional offers through December 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
Season 2 of The Sunshine Place is the story of an experimental drug rehab for teenagers called Straight Incorporated. Where kidnapping, brainwashing, and torture were disguised as therapy. It's the origin story of the troubled teen industry. How do I know this? Because I lived through it. The Sunshine Place, an Odyssey original podcast in association with Robert Downey Jr. and Susan Downey, is available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
I mean, I saw the tweet, right? I don't know what the structure of this. It's an agency that doesn't even exist right now.
Right.
So how
it'd
are
be ironic if it had a bloated budget and thousands of employees.
But again, I think this gets back to what I'm trying to say, which is that if this election was all about people being mad at elites, there's a fundamental hypocrisy of the fact that some of those very elites that they are mad at are now the ones that are in charge of this government.
Sure. I would say two things. Just because you're wealthy doesn't mean you can't help solve the problem.
No, I agree.
But at the same time, the one thing I said it to one of our co-hosts on election night, I think Musk is a genius. And I think a lot of the businesses he's in are to solve problems of the world, whether it's energy or space or whatever. He's also made himself the richest man on the planet. But there's something that makes me uneasy with him sitting next to the most powerful leader in the world with his ear on every issue there is.
Well, I think part of that is because he is a very smart person and he has had an incredible, successful career of doing really innovative things. But there's not this one-to-one translation of doing that in the private sector and then doing it in government. There's a lot of people out there that said the answer to all our problems is just hiring businessmen to run government. It's not the way it is. People mock people who spend their lives in public service, but if you have to have open heart surgery, do you want a career doctor doing that surgery? You do. If you have a plumbing problem in your house, do you want a career plumber doing it? Yes, you do. Having people who have spent their lives in public service trying to tackle tough problems is the answer to this, not necessarily putting people who know nothing about it in charge of it.
Did you read Keith Faniff's piece that came out last night?
I did.
Okay. You did or didn't?
I did.
Okay. When we come back, I'm going to read you the first paragraph and you're going to tell me what the hell is going on.
Okay.
Because I have no idea what it means. Okay. And I mean that sincerely. Do you want to start with my thoughts on the veto-proof majority, or do you want to start just straight with the budget? You choose. I'm going to give you the choice.
Oh, I'm following your lead here, man. Like, okay. You tell me where you want to go.
So before you lose people with the weeds, because I was going to read Keith's first paragraph, but somebody was telling me the other day about how this election at the state capitol, where there's a veto-proof majority and there's this intense desire to tweak the guardrails from 2017 to free up more money to spend, and that you might have a dynamic where a Democrat-controlled legislature passes the changes. The governor, who previously has indicated he doesn't want to change anything because he loves balanced budgets and surpluses and rainy day funds and paying down pension debt, and that say he vetoed it, and then the legislature would be faced with the possibility of overriding a veto from the same party. And then someone said to me that that type of scenario could disincentivize Lamont from seeking a third term. It's not my theory. Somebody put it to me. I just didn't know if is any of that possible?
I think that's more like a West Wing episode than real life. I think what's going to really happen is that the governor is going to do what he likes to do, which is to get everybody in a room and try to figure out where they go from here. And I think that he will lead on this issue of convening this conversation. Obviously, there's a lot of talk out there in the press about the guardrails from both the left and the right. I think everyone knows it's going to be a topic of conversation, including him. He'll get everybody in the room. They'll talk where they can. And I think that they'll do what we always do, which is we find a way forward and we don't have this big blow up.
Assuming that the Democrats are empowered to the point where they feel determined to do something, that means that they'll do something and he'll be involved in doing something.
Yeah, but I think I love Keith and I think he's a really smart reporter, but I think what his articles sometimes build up is that there's like this big tension out there between people and the governor on this issue. Almost every single legislator on both sides of the aisle supports the guardrails and doesn't want to get rid of them. Nobody's talking about blowing up the guardrails. They just want to find more money for the programs that matter to them. And I think there's a way to do that without blowing up the guardrails and finding some flexibility there. I think the governor understands that. And I think legislators understand that. And I think this idea that we're heading towards this cataclysmic fight is probably wrong.
Okay. If I'm going to take what you're saying at face value, and I'll get to Keith's piece in a minute, how do you allay the fears of this incrementalism thing? Because that somehow that you're going to say this to me now that we need this now and that this is it. And then in 2 years, they're going to be like, well, we need this much more. And then all of a sudden, whether it's Lamont in at the mansion or somebody else, that it's all blown up.
Because here's the truth. We created those guardrails in 2017 to solve a crisis. The crisis has been solved. We stabilized the funding.
But you don't want to backslide.
We don't want to backslide. But what I'm saying is we don't have to backslide. Nobody is saying let's get rid of all the guardrails. The guardrails were created to solve a crisis. They were created in a moment of crisis. We are out of that now. And the smart thing, back to what we talked about 20 minutes ago, was we always need to be reevaluating what is working in government and what is not. That is a smart thing to do. We don't do that nearly enough. We are going to do that in this case. Everyone thinks that paying down debt is important. Everyone thinks that building a rainy day fund is important. Everyone thinks that ending the year with a budget surplus is important. We don't have to sacrifice doing that simply to help some more programs, to give more tax relief to working families that are struggling right now, to invest in things like housing and healthcare and education. We don't it's not an either or. We can do both. We can walk and chew gum at the same time. And what I think, just, you know, we're 2 months out from the legislative session, is that this problem is going to be easier to solve than people think it is.
Well, my thing was always, and again, I was like, well, my naive and simplistic understanding is like, if the number for the volatility cap was arbitrary and every single year there's a ton of money on top of it, then it's not that volatile. So just massage that. But then you're telling me off mic that even if you do that, that doesn't mean you can just take that money and spend it. So in as simple terms as possible, can you lay it out? I don't understand any of that.
Volatility cap collects volatile revenue.
Right.
We are collecting too much volatile revenue in the estimation of both myself and too many people.
Okay.
But if we scale that back and create a 10-year average, for example, of what volatile revenue is versus what we did here, which is pegging 1 year that turned out to be not representative, we can free up some more money. Let's call it $300 or $400 million per year.
Or you could tax less, though, by the way. But yep.
You could do that.
Anyway, continue.
But that creates the spending cap problem that you just talked about. And what we also didn't talk about, with the risk of putting your listeners to sleep, is something called the bond lock, which is that in 2023, when the legislature unanimously voted to re-up the guardrails for 5 more years, we did something called the bond lock, where Treasurer Russell went to all the bondholders and they said, we will not change this for 5 years at risk of us having a problem with our bonds and our bond rating and going back on that. So there is a question of how much legally we could even do to tinker with this because of that bond lock. There are different schools of thought about that. But let's say you got past the bond lock.
Okay.
You still have the spending cap to work with.
No, explain to me, like, so if you get the extra money that by massaging the volatility cap, there's something stipulated that you can't spend it?
Correct.
Why?
Because we have a constitutional spending cap here in the state of Connecticut that was created after the income tax was instituted, as a way of saying to people, you know, Weicker said to the people of Connecticut, I'm going to temporarily levy this income tax to get us out of this crisis, but don't freak out. It's not going to be this unabated
right.
beast. We're going to put a spending cap on you. And for many years, there was not a lot of clarity about what that spending cap actually applied to. In 2017, we clarified that. It's to 9 separate funding accounts within the government. And anything that you want to do outside of that is outside the spending cap.
And are there ways? Now, last year's late session money found from ARPA was outside of the spending cap. Can they just arbitrarily just find money and use it?
So that was for one-time uses, though they didn't really use those for one-time
Correct.
So problems.
That's why we're already in a hole
but
going into next year's
budget.
But
in the article that Keith, that you mentioned, it talks about how because of our very good growth when it comes to tax collection, meaning that we're bringing in more than we estimated that we would, $620 million will be freed up for the legislature to use next year. And what my guess is, they will use part of that money to backfill what they did on non-one-time spending last year
right.
for UConn.
Which is roughly
CSU.
Half of that, probably.
And then there would be about $300 yeah. million dollars left there to invest in some of the core services that Democrats want
to invest
in. Is that
enough to satisfy all parties?
You'd have to ask my former colleagues. But I think that it's a start. And I think, going back to what I said earlier, I think the governor is really good at getting people in a room. And I think he's really good at taking the temperature down. Right now, the temperature is a little hot because of the press. That's what gets clicks and sells papers and does all that stuff. At the end of the day, we're really good in Connecticut of sitting down and working stuff out. And I think that's what's going
to
happen here.
So to summarize for people, you don't think there'll be a fight over the guardrails in the next session?
There could be a fight if it's not handled the right way. But I think it's going to be handled the right way, which is that the governor will do what he's good at and show leadership and get people in a room. The House Speaker, the Senate President are very good at what they do. I know this sounds like inside baseball to your listeners, but again, I believe in our ability to work stuff out if we talk and we listen to each other. even the Republicans. Vinny Candelora, a good friend of mine, he's the Republican leader of the House. He said the other day to Keith Faniff articles ago, we need to look at this, right? Well, when you have the Republicans even saying we need to look at it, that means there's going to be a conversation, and with conversation comes good outcomes. And I think there's a way to thread this needle where we're not backsliding back to our bad old days, but we're also being reflective of the fact that, you know, back to where we started, Donald Trump won this election because there's a lot of economic anxiety out there on both sides of the aisle. And I think if we can find a way to keep paying down the debts of the past and not make the mistakes of the past, while also freeing up some money to make sure that kids can go to community colleges at an affordable rate here in Connecticut, that we're not kicking people off the health exchange if Donald Trump kicks them off. We got to find some money to help people out and make their lives easier and more affordable, and I think we'll do it.
Gosh, I got so much more to talk about. We only have 30 seconds, and I do want to talk more about the Trump administration, but can you, in like quickly, like why is the Democratic Party so strong here and not doing so well elsewhere?
Because we allow for a big tent here, and we don't kick people out because they don't say or do all the right things all the time. And we've got rural legislators that represent Eastern Connecticut. We've got urban legislators. We've got suburban legislators. We've built a big tent coalition, and we make it work. And that's the key to success that I hope other people look at. Democrats did well here in Connecticut on Election Day last week. They did not do well nationally. The common denominator, I think, is that we've been inclusive. We talk to people, we fight the fight, and we have differences, but we work it out.
Sean Scanlon, Connecticut Comptroller, as always, thank you so much.
Good to see you.
This holiday, BMW has reunited three members of the family at the BMW Roadhome Sales Event. The Agile X3, engineered for any adventure. The plug-in hybrid X5, commanding the streets with unmatched presence. And the all-electric I4, charging into the future with impeccable performance. Hurry in to find what powers your journey at the BMW Roadhome Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine.
Hurry in for exceptional offers through December 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
Season 2 of The Sunshine Place is the story of an experimental drug rehab for teenagers called Straight Incorporated, where kidnapping, brainwashing, and torture were disguised as therapy. It's the origin story of the troubled teen industry. How do I know this? Because I lived through it. The Sunshine Place, an Odyssey original podcast in association with Robert Downey Jr. and Susan Downey, is available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.